A month after she had left for Malaysia, Patricia Curtis sent me a handwritten fax to tell me she was back in Venice and that, as promised, she would be happy to show me Palazzo Barbaro. What I had learned in her absence about the impending sale of the Piano Nobile had put the palace and Patricia Curtis in a whole new light, and not just for me. Over the years, it had been Patricia, rather than her brother or sister, or all three for that matter, who had come to be viewed as the owner of the Barbaro. She was its castellana, and in the eyes of her fellow Venetians, she was now at the center of a sad family drama. The sale of the Piano Nobile would be her loss, and her loss would be nothing less than the loss of the Barbaro itself. Local sympathies were with her, but in varying degrees of kindness. There were those who said Patricia must fight for the Barbaro. Who would she be without it? And others who understood that her passion for the palace had nothing to do with concern about social position, but arose instead from an abiding sense of duty to preserve her family's heritage and the cultural history it embodied. Patricia greeted me at the top of the courtyard stairs and ushered me into the Piano Nobile. She was cordial and relaxed, and did not appear to be, in any sense, embattled. As before, she was dressed in white, but I could see now that white for her was not a uniform white, but rather a broad spectrum of whites. Creamy white, milk white, linen white, bone white, dove white. Her blouse, slacks, shoes, and jewelry were a mix and match of whites in a casual and oddly liberating way. White was, after all, the combination of all colors of light. Her oversized white-framed glasses stood out against her tanned face. "I understand you've spoken with my brother," she said. "Yes, I have," I answered, hoping she would not regard it as a transgression. "That's all right," she said, acknowledging in just three words everything I had heard about her struggles to hold on to the palace, and at the same time letting me know she was past caring what her brother might have told me. She turned and led the way into a room with a lacquered Chinese slant-top desk and a view of the courtyard. "This is the breakfast room," she said, "which we also call the Henry James Room, because Henry James wrote at that desk." In the preface to one of his books, Henry James had described this room as having a pompous Tiepolo ceiling and walls of ancient pale green damask, slightly shredded and patched. The walls appeared to be covered with the same worse-for-wear damask, but James had apparently been mistaken about the ceiling. "He was looking at that," Patricia said, casting a glance at a celestial scene painted on the ceiling. "It's only a copy of the fresco Giambattista Tiepolo painted there in the 18th century. The original was peeled off and sold long before my great-grandparents ever came to the Barbaro. It's in New York now, at the Metropolitan Museum." Her American-accented English had European touches. She spoke the word Barbaro in the Italian manner, softly rolling the R's. We walked into the dining room and across a terrazzo floor that had a floral mosaic inlaid with mother-of-pearl, a life-size portrait of a young woman in a silvery pink, off-the-shoulder evening gown hung on the wall in a heavy gilt frame. "That's Sargent's portrait of my grandmother," she said. Lisa Colt Curtis had been an heiress to the Colt firearms fortune. Sargent had painted her standing with her hands resting lightly on the table behind her, a pose strikingly reminiscent of his controversial and decidedly less demure Madame X. We walked into the long portico. At the far end, light poured in through four Gothic windows, casting a glow on the paintings and the stucco ornamentation along the walls. At the windows, which opened onto balconies over the Grand Canal, we turned left into a small drawing room with a fireplace and walls of warm red damask that was as shredded and patched as the green damask in the room where Henry James had worked. The furniture, the paintings, and the gold leaf frames all had the patina of two centuries or more. A desk with an elegant ivory marquetry of vines and birds was worn at the edges, rubbed smooth and polished through generations of use. Carved bookshelves were filled with aged volumes. A pride of figurine lions strode across the marble mantel, below a creamy white bas-relief of children and musicians carrying flutes and tambourines.